Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the tectonic shifts underway in the US political landscape that are also occurring in Europe, where both the far left and the far right are peeling away from the traditional socialist and conservative parties in the form of more radical left parties like Podemos and Syriza, and more radical right parties like the National Front in France, gaining ground. Michael Lind, a co-founder of the New America Foundation, whose latest book is Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States, joins us to discuss how the same dynamic is underway in the United States with the traditional Republican moderates all but extinct as the GOP, which now has Ronald Reagan at its center, moves further to the right with a populist demagogue, Donald Trump, competing against a far-right ideologue, Ted Cruz, for leadership, while on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton is barely holding the center as a Democratic socialist moves the party to the left. Then we'll look into Michael Bloomberg's possible entry into the presidential race, which means that not only do we have billionaires in the back rooms deciding who will be president, we have them up front, with another billionaire considering joining Donald Trump in the race. Jeffrey Winters, a professor of political science at Northwestern University and author of Oligarchy, joins us to discuss the brazen nature of America's oligarchs, who have not only captured the economy, but are now moving not just to buy our politicians, but to buy the White House itself. Then finally, on the fifth anniversary of the Egyptian revolution in Tahrir Square that ousted the Mubarak dictatorship, we will discuss the fate of the pro-democracy activists now that euphoria has turned to despair, with Egypt firmly in control of an even more repressive military regime under General Sisi, while those who led the revolution are either in jail or in exile. Nancy O'Kale, the executive director of the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy, joins us to discuss how and why the revolution failed and what the nature of the next revolution will be. And joining us now is Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. And his latest book is Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
And it does seem to be, at least on the Republican side, a very peculiar race going on now, where instead of the focus being on which are the two best candidates, that's been turned on its head, and it's a question of which are the two worst candidates. But I take it that you feel that there's a much deeper issue involved here, and that is relates to both what's happening in Europe and what's happening here in the United States, is that there's kind of a revolution going on, if you will, that are essentially splitting up parties.
Yes, I think we're seeing a shift in the political landscape of a kind that hasn't been seen in a generation or longer. You really have to go back to the 1960s, the 1970s, the breakup of the New Deal coalition here, and a lot of the post-war social democrats in Europe, and the rise of Thatcher and Reagan, in order to see anything comparable. What's happening is that the established center-right is losing power to these national populist movements, like Trump in the United States, the National Front in France, the Sweden Democrats, a former neo-Nazi party, who are now the largest of several parties in Sweden. And meanwhile, the center-left, particularly the ones who were third-way neoliberals, like Clinton and Blair, who followed austerity and balanced budgets combined with social liberalism, they have pretty much collapsed in Western Europe. The Labour Party has imploded. With the rise of a far left under Jeremy Corbyn. And I think you see something similar going on here. That is, if in a transatlantic perspective, the weakness of the center left and the center right and the rise of figures on the left like Bernie Sanders, a self-described socialist, and a populist and nationalist like Trump, it looks very much similar to what's going on the other side of the Atlantic.
So what's driving this? It sort of reminds me of the great poem by William Butler Yeats, The Second Coming, turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosened. And everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity.
Well, that's a somewhat pessimistic take on it.
Well, slouching towards Bethlehem, yeah, I know.
I tend to think that things go through historical phases, which are ultimately driven by undercurrents rooted in technology and economics and demography. So, for example, in the middle of the 20th century, you had this growing industrial proletariat, which had to be incorporated in various ways, both by the conservatives and the liberals on both sides of the Atlantic. And that was when you had the New Deal, when you had Eisenhower, Republican, strong manufacturing unions. By the 70s and 80s and 90s, because of technology, far more people worked in the service sector than in the manufacturing, and so the unions lost power in societies on both sides of the Atlantic. I think what you're seeing now is a combination of demography and technological change. Technological change is wiping out most of what remains of manufacturing jobs that have not been offshored as they become automated and as robots do more and more. And most of the new jobs being created in the U.S. and similar societies, some of them are high-wage, high-skill jobs, but the majority of them are in the non-traded service sector, things like home health aid, floor walker in malls and shopping centers. And they're very low-wage, low-benefit jobs. So you're seeing the children and grandchildren of well-paid, unionized factory workers becoming this very low-wage service proletariat of all races. That's the one trend. The demographic trend is, in the United States as well as in Western Europe, the natives are not having enough children to maintain the population. So absent immigration, the national populations would be shrinking. But the immigration, it comes from different sources in the U.S. It's mostly Mexico and Latin America. It's largely North African now in Europe and Middle Eastern. But this creates backlashes. There's always a clash over large groups of immigrants and competition over wages and culture and so on. So I think these are the trends that are driving this. You have this declining white majority, which, and at the same time, an even more rapidly declining, well-paid working class. So the society is both changing ethnically, and most of the gains for growth are going to the owners of capital rather than to well-paid workers.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is the co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And his nonfiction books include The American Way of Strategy, What Lincoln Believed, and his latest is The Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. But I was in referring to the Yeats poem, which of course was written at the time of the rise of fascism in Europe. The idea that that the center cannot hold, the implication is that there's a failure, that people move to the extremes out of frustration and anger. And usually when democracy fails, more illiberal forms of government succeed them. So, I mean, I'm not suggesting that Bernie Sanders is anything like that, I think, but you could certainly suggest that the Trump-Cruz phenomenon, it could take us not so much towards fascism, but towards a right-wing version of American populism.
Well, maybe so, but let's be clear, the center that is failing is one that we should say good riddance, to as it departs. The failing center, the center that's collapsing on both sides of the Atlantic, essentially was conservative economically. It was responsible for massive deregulation, anti-union, cuts in the social democratic welfare state under not only conservatives like Reagan and Thatcher, but neoliberals like Clinton and Blair. The foreign policy of the so-called centrists for the last generation got us into Iraq, Afghanistan, I think, was at least initially was justified, but the completely unnecessary Iraq war, toppling Gaddafi in Syria, creating chaos everywhere. So, you know, if ever there were a center that deserved not to hold, it's this particular center, in my view, with its neoliberal austerity economics combined with neoconservative militaristic foreign policy. That doesn't mean that it will be replaced by anything better. It might be replaced by something worse. But I think it's time for a change.
Well, that's definitely a given. That's time for a change. But what are the agents of change? I mean, Bernie Sanders is talking about something that's very clear and present, which is the growing disparity of wealth and how that has to be reversed. On the Republican side, there's some of that in an inchoate way, but mostly just sort of, you know, a sort of faux nationalism and a kind of anger without any specific programs. I mean, there's a vast difference, at least, between the fact that the Democrats at least have debates, discuss issues. I haven't heard of anything on the Republican side that indicates there's a plan or a program, just a bunch of anger.
Well, there is some change on the Republican side with some younger conservatives who are called reformicons or reform conservatives. And they have been pushing back against the sort of libertarian Wall Street Journal economics, saying that one reason Republican voters are revolting is the GOP economic plan has been based on tax cuts for the rich. But so they haven't had much influence yet. Trump's plan slashes taxes for the super rich just as much as Jeb Bush's and Rubio's and Cruz's and all the other. No, you're absolutely right about the programs. If my analysis is correct about these demographic and workforce changes, then none of these candidates really are dealing with the main problems. On the right, you have Trump's nationalism, his anti-Chinese, you know, trade stuff. To some degree, it's legitimate. I mean, China has cheated. It is a mercantilist state. But it's not going to help many American workers because the vast majority of workers are not working in the traded sector and not affected by international trade. It's more by domestic labor conditions. On the left, both Sanders and Clinton have singled out the super rich, you know, at least rhetorically, as this great source of money. But if you're going to have a generous retirement system and health care for all and so on, you're going to have to raise taxes on the middle class and working class, too. It can't simply be higher taxes on rich people. And to his credit, Sanders includes this in his plan, whereas Hillary Clinton has sworn she will never raise taxes on anyone making less than $250,000 a year, defined as the upper limit of the middle class. For her part, you know, Hillary has some good incremental ideas, but they're incremental ideas, expansions of child care and, you know, some help for the poor here and there and so on. But they're not going to address the real basic question, which is, how do you share the gains from economic growth, which is chugging along moderately well? It's not great. It's not bad. But we still have technological innovation and productivity growth. How do you share the gains, which are going mostly to investors and a few high-paid managers, with a population, most of whom in advanced technological societies will be in fairly low-skill, not terribly well-organized jobs? And neither the left, the right, nor the center really has a convincing answer. The left focuses on the safety net, which is good, expanding the safety net for people who are sick or unemployed or retired. But the basic question of, you know, how do you connect paychecks and work with the engine of economic growth, this is something that's not really, you know, nobody really has a plan on the table.
So, in terms of, though, of a social contract, we don't really have the sort of kind of social contracts that they do have in social democracies. And arguably there was some sort of social democracy in this country from, say, about 47 to about 1977. But it seems to me that in what you're saying, you're implying that there should be a new social contract and that nobody's really talking about it.
Well, there are a few policy wonks and intellectuals talking about it, but it hasn't really become part of the debate. The basic question has to do with wages, and there are only two ways that you can raise the incomes of working people, assuming that you've slashed their taxes for the bottom half of the population, which is something we've already done. Either get their employers to pay them more or supplement their low wages they make at their jobs with some kind of either in-kind benefits, which could take free college, free health care, you know, other free or subsidized benefits, or it can take the form of wage supplements or subsidies. That is, the government would supplement your market wage with some kind of cash transfer every 2 weeks. And it could do this either through the employer or directly. And the earned income tax credit does it in a very crude and somewhat inefficient way at the end of the year. Robert Reich, the former labor secretary for Bill Clinton, has proposed having a middle class qualify as well for the earned income tax credit. And some on the right are talking about wage subsidies. But this is still sort of an avant-garde idea. And I tend to be in favor of in-kind benefits, that is, more free so-called merit goods, such as a free health care and free higher education, for the simple reason that if you have wage subsidies paid for by the taxpayers, essentially the taxpayer through the government is subsidizing low-wage employers. So they do not have to pay living wages to their workers. And I'm not sure that's the path we're going to go down. It's the right path to go down. But I think that's the sort of thing that ought to be debated. But instead, we're hearing mostly from the right about cutting off immigrant competition at the lower end of the wage scale, which frankly would help, you know, some low-wage workers who do compete with immigrants in some industries. But it's not going to deal with the malaise affecting the vast middle-class population in the U.S. And on the left, as I said, it's mostly about the safety net rather than about jobs and wages and your biweekly income.
Well, your landscape is not as depressing as Yeats's The Second Coming.
But well, I prefer the, you know, the joke in the World War One Vienna. The quote of that the Viennese like to repeat was, "The situation is desperate but not serious."
Well, on that note, Michael Lind, not that it's cheerful. I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. And his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the fact that billionaires are not just in the back rooms, they're up front in the presidential race. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jeffrey Winters, who's a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes in oligarchs and elites, spanning a range of historic and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe, the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, and the Philippines. He also studies state-capital relations, capital mobility, and the structural power of investors. The International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and the World Bank, human rights, authoritarianism, and democratic transition in post-colonial states. He's the author of Oligarchy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Winters.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And this is pretty extraordinary that if Michael Bloomberg enters the race as he's threatening to do, you'll have two bona fide billionaires running. And the point that I made in the introduction was that not only do we have billionaires in the back room deciding who'll be president, we'll have them up front, in the race. So is this to say then that America's oligarchy is getting incredibly brazen? Not only have they captured the economy, but now they're moving not just to buy our politicians, but to buy the White House itself.
Yeah, this is actually a new phenomenon in United States politics. It used to be that the wealthiest Americans really wanted to stay in the background and exert their influence, not by directly paying for and buying outright office for themselves, but really to fund others and put them forward. Bloomberg, of course, has already practiced this in New York, a three-time mayor of New York. He funded himself all three times when he ran. But now we're seeing a pattern where the confidence of the ultra-wealthy in the United States to just go forward and use their money in this very bold way is really quite new.
So what's your sense then of how this is going to work out? Because you've got on the left, you've got Bernie Sanders making the case that the greatest issue, at least the one that he concentrates more on than anything else, I think, is the growing disparity of wealth and the need to tax Wall Street to help Main Street. After all, Main Street bailed out Wall Street. So his is a call for justice, and certainly not even his tax plans, even nowhere near as radical as the great Republican Dwight D. Eisenhower, who taxed the rich at 92%. But on the other side, you've actually got a bona fide billionaire who's leading, and as far as I can tell, most of them are still talking about the same old tax cuts for the rich. You know, they dress them up slightly differently. They talk about the deficit and the growing, looming deficit, etc. But that's always been used as a rubric to cut taxes on the wealthy, at any rate. So, I don't. It seems to me that in terms of our politics, there's not much to pin your hopes on except Bernie Sanders.
Well, you started out by making a really important point, which is that although people call Bernie Sanders on the far left, and although he likes to use the term socialist, which, you know, ought to, in most American contexts, just disqualify him, the real fact is that Bernie Sanders, by any historic American standard, is a moderate. But because the country has moved so far to the right, and because the power of the wealthy is so extreme today, he's being called extreme. He's viewed as on the extreme left. But you're quite right that by even just second half of the 20th century standards, Bernie Sanders is really a middle-of-the-road Democrat. So that's just the first point. But you've captured something also that is very interesting, which is we may very well, depending on how this works out, and to the horror of the GOP establishment and the Democratic Party establishment, we may end up with a Trump-Sanders race, which is precisely why Bloomberg is toying with the idea of jumping in. But if we do, what does that represent? And I would put it this way, Ian. On the one hand, Bernie Sanders is the only candidate in this entire contest who isn't in some way either self-funding as a billionaire or relying on billionaires to get there. And in a sense, then, the swell of resources that are coming from millions of Americans on a very small scale is a way for that base to say, we're angry about wealth inequality and especially the distortion of money in our politics and the kind of power that expresses. On the other side, Donald Trump, well, as you know, around 2040, more or less, the United States is going to become what is called minority white. That is, Caucasians in the United States are going to be an absolute minority for the first time in the country's history. And there's a lot of nervousness and there's a lot of anger and anxiety about that in the United States. And in a way, Donald Trump is really tapping into that minority white fear, anxiety. That's why we see so much talk about immigrants, Islam, Christianity, English language, and all that kind of stuff, borders, erecting walls. So we've got two kinds of anxieties being played out here, or angers. One is sort of more race-based, and the other one has to do with anger toward oligarchs and distortions of wealth.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Winters, a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes on oligarchs and elites, spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe, the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, and the Philippines. He's the author of Oligarchy. So the other person, though, up there and not a little bit behind Trump, but certainly making a run for it on the Republican side, is Ted Cruz. And he's pretty brazen because he's running against the establishment, against what he calls the Washington cartel. And yet his recent rise in Iowa is due to the fact that four billionaires have tossed money into the race. And now, of course, I think Trump is, because of his rather clever moves of bringing in Sarah Palin and getting the popular senator to at least not, if not endorse him, appear on stage with him, he seems to be looks like he's going to win in Iowa. But nevertheless, Ted Cruz, his backers include New York hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer, Texas natural gas billionaire Farris and Dan Wilkes, one of whom is has his own church. He's a Christian fundamentalist, and Toby Neugebauer, a private equity fellow. So what do you make of that? I mean, here's a guy that got $1 million loan from Goldman Sachs and Citibank to get elected senator, and yet he seems to be at least getting away with it in part, running against the establishment.
Yeah, it's well, one of the things we're seeing over and over is that a limited number of people here in the United States who have massive, massive resources are able to intervene like this and throw a lifeline to someone like Ted Cruz, who's been struggling, and they can boost him back up into play. And what we see is that a couple things. One, resources alone can't give you a win. That is, we don't just tally up who has the most money and then we just know in some kind of simple way, oh, that person's going to win the election. I mean, voting in the United States still does matter. But what money does is money keeps you alive. Money keeps you in the game. Money can elevate you, especially in the primaries. And so what we're really seeing, again, with the exception of Bernie Sanders, is we are seeing a whole spectrum of candidates who are in play because they're able to attract massive amounts of money from very rich people, or, with the exception of Donald Trump, just uses the money himself from his own bank account. So, I mean, this is where we're at in the United States in terms of democracy. Ted Cruz is relevant not because of what policies he stands for, but because he's able to attract what looks like panic money flowing toward him. And there's tremendous disarray in the GOP as well, because the way this used to work was that rich people would funnel their money toward the party mainly, and then the party establishment would sort of fund whatever candidates they thought fit the party view. Well, what's happened now with the Koch brothers, for example, two of the wealthiest people in the United States, is they've gathered together other like-minded wealthy people, and they've pulled together a fund for this year's election that amounts to about $890 million that they plan on spending for candidates. That is more than the Republican Party has in total. And so we just have a group of billionaires who are sort of sidestepping the party now, because we have a new campaign finance world in the United States, thanks to Citizens United and so on. And so the party establishment is in an absolute panic over the way things are going. And if Bernie Sanders continues to rise, the Democratic Party is also in complete shock and disarray.
Well, that we were talking about that actually with our first guest, Michael Lynn, who actually suggested that it's not just a phenomenon here in the United States, where traditional Republicans, moderate, are all but extinct, and the GOP now has Ronald Reagan at its center, and it's moving farther to the right with the populist demagogue Donald Trump competing against a far right ideologue Ted Cruz. And on the Democratic side, of course, you've got Hillary Clinton, who's barely holding onto the center as this Democratic socialist moves the party to the left. And the same is happening in Europe, where the far right and the far left are peeling away from the traditional socialist and conservative parties, with more radical parties on the left like Podemos and Syriza, and more radical parties on the right like the National Front in France. So, do you see that as a bigger trend, in the sense that the traditional parties are failing?
Well, yes. So one of the things that's happening, and the United States is emblematic of this, is think of the people who are behind Donald Trump as one kind of base of the Republican Party. And as I mentioned before, there's a certain kind of anger and anxiety they're expressing. And then think of the people who are backing Bernie Sanders as another base, the Democratic base, and they're the more ideological ones. They're more concerned with questions of inequality and wealth and so on. And then the gap that's really opening up is not only between those two base constituencies, which happen to be quite far apart from each other, but there's a gap opening up between the leaders of the parties and their base. And one of the things that's doing this is the shift in the resources that make elections possible. And this is happening not only in Europe, but it's happening here in the United States as well. So what we're seeing is, think of the parties as institutions that have longstanding politicians in them, and you work your way up through the party by sort of aligning yourself with the party's views. Think of those institutions as being relatively conservative bodies. Although they may move to the right over time, the bases we're seeing in countries are becoming more polarized. And these polarizations are reflecting differences in wealth. They're reflecting anxieties between racial and ethnic groups. The United States is not the only place that is changing dramatically in racial and ethnic ways, but also countries in Europe, as migrations of populations increase. So societies around the world are wrestling with these issues, and we're watching them play out now in the kinds of really surprising candidacies we're seeing in the United States this year.
So the Koch brothers, who you mentioned, of course, they had a secret conclave out here in Newport Beach, where they organized all of their billionaire friends, and they came up with that pledges of close to $900 million. But the focus was to defeat Hillary, So I take it they won't have a big problem shifting their sights to defeating Bernie.
Well, right. How interesting that the so-called smart money was not able to foresee the direction that things are taking in this election cycle. I think people wrote off Bernie Sanders at the outset. What's interesting is, very simple, ordinary people by the millions have been paying a lot of attention to him. His message has resonated among them. And to everyone's surprise, and I'm sure the Koch brothers are thinking about this as well, they may end up deploying all those resources to try to not defeat someone like Hillary Clinton, a centrist, for most part, and in some senses in foreign policy, a hawk, an outright hawk. They may be deploying their money against a democratic socialist in the United States. I think if this happens, fasten your seatbelts politically, because this is going to be a stunning political process to watch.
And meanwhile, all of those people like Adelson and company seem to be wasting their money on the Cruises, the Jeb Bushes, the Christies, you name it. There's about 14 of them, all of whom look like bad bets.
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of waste of resources, but you also have to think about it this way. Just as in investing, how you hedge your money and you bet on a number of different scenarios and possibilities, that's done in politics as well, and that's not only in the United States. It's in countries all over the world. You can't really predict where the outcome is going to be, and so you spread your money around. You give some to Cruz, you give some to Rubio, some to Jeb Bush, and later, once you see how things are shaking out, that's when you really start to deploy the big money. This is an interesting contrast, by the way, again, just to bring up the Sanders element. What we saw in 2008 with Barack Obama was he did get catapulted at the beginning with a lot of small donations. But what happened in Barack Obama's case was once it became clear that he had a lot of strength in the primaries, massive amounts of big money flowed to Barack Obama, including Wall Street money.
So
the difference with Bernie Sanders is that he has pledged that if he becomes very strong in the primaries and emerges as the Democratic front runner, no matter what, he won't accept money from billionaires, hedge funds, and Wall Street.
Well, Jeffrey Winters, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Winters, who's a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes on oligarchs and elites expanding throughout history from ancient Athens and Rome to the United States. And he's the author of Oligarchy. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking at the fifth anniversary of the Egyptian Revolution in Tahrir Square. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nancy O'Kale, who is the Executive Director of the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. She has worked with the Egyptian government as a senior evaluation officer of foreign aid and has managed programs for Egyptian pro-democracy organizations that challenged the Mubarak regime. She was also one of the defendants convicted and sentenced to prison in the widely publicized case of 43 non-governmental organizations workers charged with using foreign funds to foment unrest in Egypt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nancy O'Kale.
Thank you for having me.
And 5 years ago, pro-democracy activists flooded into Tahrir Square, and 18 days later, the long-serving dictator Hosni Mubarak fell, and there was a great deal of hope around the world, and particularly in Egypt. But now, many of those that helped organize that pro-democracy rebellion have been either in exile or in prison. And my understanding from what I've heard from people in Egypt and those who have escaped, that Egypt is more repressed today than it was under Mubarak. Is that your understanding?
The conditions right now in Egypt is indeed repressive, and they are an extension of all the problems that Egypt has suffered from under Mubarak. Just, of course, things got worse and exaggerated. So everything that we're seeing right now in terms of restrictions on civil society, impunity in dealing with sectarian attacks, repression of freedom of the press, freedom of expression, free and fair elections or fair competitive electoral processes, the politicization of the judiciary, all these were problems that existed under Mubarak. However, right now is getting worse and worse because there is more centralization of power and concentration of power, particularly within the military. And all the channels for political engagement has been shut down.
And I take it that you yourself have a death sentence hanging over your head?
It's a 5 year prison sentence, luckily not a death sentence.
Say that again. I'm sorry, it broke up.
It's a 5 year prison sentence.
Oh, a 5 year prison sentence. I see.
Yeah.
But that, obviously, you're not about to go back to Egypt.
Unless I need a room with a view. It's an effective final verdict, and I can't go back to Egypt, so I'm living a political exile right now in the United States.
So, but you're not alone, are you? Many of those that led the demonstrations, and particularly the executive with Google, he's living in exile, is he not?
I believe he's outside of Egypt. I'm not sure it would be technically seen as exile. But generally, most of the people who were active during the revolution are now either outside of the country or inside the country, but they're not really able to conduct their work freely. They are being intimidated or under threat of being imprisoned. So whether the people who were part of the revolution are inside or outside of the country, they're no longer able to conduct effective work as they had hoped to during the early days of 2011.
Well, one of the better-known pro-democracy activists, Alaa Abdel Fattah, is in prison, has a sentence like yours, 5 years, for violating the 2013 anti-protest law. And his latest messages from prison are pretty depressing. Is there a sense that everybody's given up, that they feel defeated?
Well, definitely it's not a triumphant moment. It's a very dismal point today. I mean, looking at where we were 5 years ago and where we are today. However, I mean, the point that people are depressed or given up, I wouldn't say so. Even while people would claim as such, everyone is trying to do their best within the limits that they have, in a way that we don't know what the red lines are. But civil society actors are still trying to gather information, document violations against human rights, try to take their battles to the two courts, and there are some small wins. They're not great, but no one has completely given up. But of course, all these attempts within the overall scheme of things and how things are, the conditions of repression in the country, of course, it doesn't really lead to the effect or the impact that one would have hoped 5 years ago.
And again, I'm speaking with Nancy O'Kale, who's the executive director of the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. She has worked with the Egyptian government as a senior evaluations officer of foreign aid and has managed programs for Egyptian pro-democracy organizations that challenge the Mubarak regime. And she was also one of the defendants convicted and sentenced to 5 years in prison in the widely publicized case of 43 non-governmental organization workers charged with using foreign funds to foment unrest in Egypt. And, of course, the trial of the CNN reporters, of course, got a lot of attention. The trial of you and the cases of involving you and 43 others have gotten less international attention. But I understand that the hidden element, or at least the least publicized element in all of this, is the role of Saudi Arabia. I understand that at the time of Tahrir, the then Saudi king was on the phone screaming at Barack Obama, "You've got to let Mubarak shoot those kids in the square," you know. And then they clearly funded Sisi's comeback. The minute that Sisi came back, suddenly there was food on the shelves and gasoline at the gas stations, etc. And that the Saudis really are threatened by any other form of government but the feudal kind of reactionary government they have, along with the fact, of course, that the al-Sauds claim to be the custodians of the holy shrines of Islam, and the only competition to their so-called religious authenticity comes from Egypt itself. So walk me through the role of Saudi Arabia in this, if indeed you agree with that thesis.
Well, actually, I would have a concern in singling out one country and the impact of their intervention within the political dynamics in Egypt. And overall, as you just phrased it at the beginning when you said the kids of Tahrir Square, and this perception had a lot of implication on the actual policy. The view was these are the kids, the innocent youth who took the Tahrir Square, had a good cause, but now it's time to deal with government, so they should stay home, and we're going to go back to business as usual with working with government to government and dealing with the head of the state no matter what. And then that also follows into the process of support or intervention that international policymakers usually deal with governments and focus on procedural democracy, taking steps into supporting elections or referendum and supporting presidential elections. But then they would turn a blind eye on the violations that happened in terms of freedom of expression, support for the right to peacefully protest, and the crackdown on dissent in general. Well, that is the overall atmosphere in which these young, aspiring Egyptians were supposed to operate and work within in order to achieve their goals. However, the intervention of international organizations would support the rulers over the people, which is completely the opposite of the rhetoric that we've heard in speeches from not just Saudi Arabia or the U.S. around the world, saying this, like, now it's the time to stand on the right side of history. But actually, that never translated into actual policy. It's just we went back immediately into business as usual, dealing with the head of the state, supporting or exchanging government-to-government support while ignoring the demands and the wills of the people themselves.
But it seemed to me that all along, starting with Tahrir 5 years ago, there's been the invisible hand, if you will, of the military behind the scenes. They did seem to have influence over the first election, in effect, making it so that, if you will, the worst possible Islamist candidate, Mohamed Morsi, got elected. Nobody from the left seemed to make it. And then when the coup, counter-coup started against Morsi, engineered again by the military, with the help of the liberals, with joining Tamarud. And I remember talking to an Egyptian pro-democracy activist at the time, who was, as soon as Sisi got rid of Morsi and took over, he said, you know, now that they're going to go after the Islamists, after the Muslim Brotherhood first, but after that, they're going to come after us, the liberals. So tell me about what you think was the role of the military all along. Did they have their eye on the ball from day one? And was there any way to prevent this outcome that we've seen?
Well, the Egyptian military is the most powerful institute in Egypt and the most organized and resourceful. And that's since 1952, since the first coup or revolution. And since then, Egypt has been under military rule. We've always been governed by military men. Mubarak has stayed long enough to kind of expand his network beyond the military guard around him. But still, at the end of the day, the military was in power. Whether it was the Supreme Council of Armed Forces when they were governing during the period after the ouster of Mubarak until the presidential election and the election of Morsi as president, or under the one-year rule of Morsi, or the following transitional period where President Mansour was residing over the transition and under Sisi. Throughout all this time, the head of the state has changed, but the tools and the main powerful institutions that control the country were the same, regardless. I mean, like, even if you look at President Sisi himself, he was an appointee of Morsi. Morsi had appointed him as the Minister of Defense at his time, and he was using pretty much the same tools of repression that was used throughout the history of Egypt since 1952. Repression through first of all, the use of the control of state media and government propaganda, following that by actual practical repressions and arrests and imprisonment, and then following that by changing the laws and rules in order to legitimize the process of repression. And all the institutions of, like, the judiciary, the Ministry of Interior and the intelligence, I mean, the security and access, and the media, whereas, like, this triangle has always been used by the governors, whoever they are, in order to control and repress any form of dissent.
So then what does this say about the U.S.'s arrangement with the Egyptian military, who received, since the Camp David Accord, billions of dollars every year from the U.S. taxpayer? Obviously, there's always been calls, particularly during Tahrir, to cut those ties. They've never been cut. And do you think that that has contributed to the immunity and autonomy that the Egyptian military has had in terms of its dominance of that country?
Well, I mean, from the perspective in the United States, it's also serving its own interests when it's providing this $1.3 billion a year in military aid. It's for the sake of stability and security and the relationship with Israel. And that's important also to maintain its leverage. However, I mean, the problem with that is like the monolithic kind of viewpoint, if you may put it this way, that it sees the security solution as the only solution for stability, or the only road towards stability. Whereas Egypt is actually facing real terror threat, and the terror attacks in Egypt are on the rise since 2013. However, I mean, the assumption that the use of military force alone would solve the problem is a myth. And the problem is that the focus on this one-sided view of seeing military support as the only way towards stability is misguided. And we've learned from recent history that, I mean, the most stable regimes that use force in order to maintain stability have collapsed after a few weeks of protests. So injustice, the lack of freedom, the repression and the closure of any peaceful road to political engagement are actually more powerful reasons that create instability than just the military or security side alone.
Well, just in closing, though, it would seem, Nancy O'Kale, that if there is to be another revolution, it's more likely, isn't it, to come from the Islamists who have been repressed. And after all, there's an awful lot of people in the country who supported the Muslim Brotherhood than it is to come from the liberals and the secular people who have equally been crushed. So where do you expect the backlash to come from?
Well, speaking of another revolution is a little bit hard to perceive right now because it's hard to see unified groups getting together behind one cause. However, I have a concern here when we think of Egypt or other countries in the Middle East, that the divide is along the fault lines of religious versus liberal, where actually the main dividing lines are more along the poverty lines and economic and rural versus urban. And this can be actually the view is like how people are actually suffering and under economic distress. Maybe the mobilizing fact for people to not necessarily revolt, but have any form of civil disobedience or protest or strikes. And we've seen, we are currently seeing these forms of protest. And I would see this more of a possible scenario rather than looking at it as Islamist versus liberal and that the Islamists would be the more likely force behind that. Because even the Islamists right now are, their organization, if we talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, they are having their own internal problems and schisms, if we may put it this way. And I don't think they are as powerful as or as organized as they were 5 years ago or even before that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Nancy O'Kale.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Nancy O'Kale, who's Executive Director of the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. She has worked with the Egyptian government as a Senior Evaluations Officer of Foreign Aid and has managed programs for Egyptian pro-democracy organizations that challenged the Mubarak regime. And she was also one of the defendants convicted and sentenced to prison in the widely publicized case of 43 non-governmental organization workers charged with using foreign funds to foment unrest in Egypt. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.